So this is the first Dharma talk of this four-day retreat. This four-day retreat, which is entitled A Path to Wholeness. Mindfulness, deep looking, joyful effort, and the unified mind. The path to wholeness. It's interesting because, you know, in Buddhism there are various traditions and lineages. In some of the traditions and practice paths, it is sort of a, we could say it is a linear path. One begins in brokenness. One begins in delusion, one begins in suffering, and through assiduous and diligent and consistent practice of the Eightfold Path, the Six Paramitas, etc., one over time arrives at wholeness. The direct experience paths, such as Zen and what's called the Great Perfection, paths that have a lot of similarity, they work it totally differently. And they begin with wholeness. They state right from the beginning, right now, each and every one of us is intrinsically whole. Each one of us, right now, have nothing wrong with them at all. And that all we have to do is to recognize that, wake up to that, and live in that truth. And that is the practice. So we might say the path to wholeness is not, it's not like we're here and wholeness is there. Right? I'm at the bottom of the mountain and I have to walk up this mountain to arrive at wholeness. Wholeness is right here. I just have to wake up to it. So the practices of mindfulness, deep looking, joyful effort, unified mind, etc., are means to doing that. But it is essential that we understand that when you are practicing in this tradition, you are practicing in a tradition that states right from the very beginning that everyone is whole and complete. Everybody is endowed with the Buddha mind. Right. And that should mean something to us. I think everybody in this room has heard that over and over and over again ad nauseum. But we still act as if we're broken. We still act as if we have a lot of fixing to do. Right now, sitting here, listening to me, if you are listening wholly, and if you are wholly, wholeheartedly, just listening. Not a thought in your mind, and not a concept in your mind, you're just listening. Where is your brokenness? Where are your issues? If they are real, they would be here. But if in this moment, in your deep listening, they are not here, and you're capable to listen in wholeness, that should show you that your whole nature is always available to you. But we forget. We don't remember. And so we have to do all these other things because we forget the essential point. It is a very bold path that is willing to state right from the beginning that all beings are Buddha. That all beings are endowed with the Buddha mind. And there are many Zen teachers who have, when asked, what is this Buddha mind, they say things like, everyday mind is Buddha mind. Because again, we think that our Buddha mind is somewhere else. It can't be this everyday mind of mine. It's like somebody on a cloudy day denying that there's a blue sky up there, that the sun is shining, because they only see the clouds. They don't see what's really there. Today is actually quite a beautiful day, isn't it? And we are gathered here on the banks of the Hillsborough River. It is flowing gently. We are here on these park-like grounds of the Franciscan Center with beautiful oak trees, pine trees, cypress trees. There's a beautiful, pristine, vast blue sky to remind us of our vast mind. So we have wonderful conditions. We have people to feed us. And not only do they feed us, they clean up after us. So that is really a treat. Our beds are made. There's hot, cold, running water. What more do we need? Already we are, we have more good fortune than most of the people on this earth today, just sitting here. So we have great fortune. We don't notice that, do we, often? We don't remember that. And if we're not careful, we find all sorts of little reasons to be dissatisfied, or want something to be different, or right. That is the product of a sick mind. Right. To always notice what's wrong and not what's right. So we are here in this beautiful place with all these wonderful supports to practice wakefulness, more specifically to practice mindfulness, concentration, which I called the unified mind, diligent effort, and deep looking. These fundamental practices of the awakened mind, the awakened practitioner. But I want to begin in another direction, a direction that many of you are familiar with, and it may be heard, again, thousands of times ad nauseum. But the reason I want to begin here is many times people, when they have questions or concerns about their practice, about their mindfulness practice, their meditation practice, their concentration practice, all these kinds of things, they think the problem is in their meditative practice, and therefore they're looking for the solution in their meditative practice. But often they are really missing the real cause of their problem. So in this tradition, you know, we look deeply. And looking deeply means we are looking into cause and effect. And we want to see what types of causes could be contributing to this effect. So if I have a distracted mind, if I still have a lot of emotional afflictions, fears and anxieties, sadnesses, despair, so a lot of anger, resentment, you know, we might say, well, what's wrong with my meditation practice? It should be taking care of this. Again, we are misunderstanding the Buddha Dharma. For example, when the Buddha first, after his great enlightenment, encountered his former fellow ascetics, right, in the Deer Park, after his great enlightenment, transformation, the first thing when he encountered them, he didn't give them a teaching about meditation, did he? Concentration, did he? No. He taught first the Four Noble Truths. Very interesting. To me, that's very interesting. Because he understood there had to be some sort of understanding about what's going on in this life that would help us see more clearly so we could get our priorities straight. You see, because if we have an experience, an encounter with meditation or with, you know, concentration or insight, if we have those kinds of encounters, but there's no context in which to put those encounters, those encounters will ultimately just fizzle out. And that is why many of us may find over the years, you know, we read the books, we go to the retreats, we, you know, listen to the talks, but somehow they always seem to more or less fizzle out in life, in our daily life. Why is that? See, those are the kind of interesting questions. So they're really important questions. So that when we do undertake significant dedication to a meditative practice, it produces the results it's supposed to produce. So a lot of times we are Americans. We're bright. We get it. You know, just give me the core teaching. Give me the high teaching. I can understand it. Well, we maybe understand it, but we can't practice and realize the fruit of it. And that is because we're still caught over here. I was just talking to somebody the other day, somebody who I've known has been practicing in our community for 15 years. Lots of retreats, lots of intensives, lots of dedicated study. And he was saying he finds himself emotionally right back in the dark hole. Right? And he wanted me to help him get out of the hole, as I have done many times in the past. And my response to him was, you know, if there's anybody who knows all the techniques of getting out of the hole, it's you. You know, you've been there so many times and you know what to do. You know, your question is why again? See, why again? And one of the things I said to him, I could, you know, we were on an intensive call, so we only had a few minutes. One of the things I said to him is, because you don't take refuge in the Buddha Dharma Sangha. I know you've taken formal refuge, and you say it, and you know, and we said it this morning, but in your heart you haven't. Because when you've taken refuge in the Buddha Dharma Sangha, you've really said, that this is where I place my trust until I attain enlightenment, which means until I have clear seeing myself, clear understanding myself, and have a very enlightened inner compass that I can trust to guide me. But until we get to that point of confidence, and that is what we all want to get to, a point where we have this inner confidence, the voice of the Buddha is within us. It is our own Buddha nature that is guiding us. But until we get there, we need external supports. Because if we listen to our own voice, which is always conditioned by the past and always contaminated by self, that voice that we are looking to getting us out of the problem is the very one who created the problem. Right? If you want to keep your hens safe, you don't hire the fox. Right? If you want to work your way out of your problems, you don't, call on the one who created the problems to advise you. Right? So taking refuge is not like, beginner practice. Taking refuge is a deep, deep practice. Because to take refuge means I have to surrender my powerful, overweening, strong belief in myself, my I, my ego, and all its skewed understandings about life. It is because of that that we the problems arise. So when the problems arise, if we are not looking to a body of knowledge or a person or something that has resolved that issue, and if we don't listen to them, we will continue to go round and round and round in our own mental fabrications and our own lopsided interpretations of Dharma. So to take refuge in the Buddha means to really take refuge, and the Dharma means to take really refuge in those teachings and practices that have been transmitted from the Buddha through all the teachers to your own teacher today, and to rely on that. That's what refuge means. I rely on that. I trust that. When I'm in trouble, that's what I listen to. Rather than my own confabulation, which is obviously distorted because here I am again. I mean, if there's any proof that we have that the advice we're following is not correct advice, well, look where we are again, So again, these are something that we need to reflect on deeply, because if we haven't really taken refuge and really established, like in the verses we did today, right? Trust in mind. That used to be translated as faith, but that's actually a mistranslation. That's why we changed it. The actual meaning is trust or confidence, which is very different, isn't it? To trust the three jewels, not like as things on an altar that we bow to, but that is living principles that we take to guide us. Until we are so assured of their rightness, not like in a theological sense. Rightness is in the fact that they are true. They are apt. They are very simple, accurate descriptions of life. They are very accurate descriptions about the mind. They are accurate descriptions about what causes suffering and what causes happiness, right? And they are very, when we understand that, then and we understand that this is a workable a path of teachings and practices that has experience for 2,600 years, and that millions and millions and millions of people have liberated themselves through their practice, and that these are the same exact teachings that are being shared with us today, we can trust them. We can have confidence in them. And then if we practice, as directed, we will experience that ourselves, and our confidence will now be an inner confidence, because it's our own experience. We see how these things work. So this is just one example. Another example that I said to this gentleman, beside that you really haven't taken refuge, even though you have thought you have for 15 years, how do I know he hasn't taken refuge? Because I can see where he goes when things get a little rough. I also said, you still don't get it about life. It's like, you don't get it. That when you read the Buddhist teachings about impermanence, that things are always changing, that things go up and down and back and forth. When you read the teachings of the eight worldly winds that blow through this life, success and failure, fame and infamy, pleasure, pain. When you still are in that changeable universe, you're still looking for stability, right? You're still looking for reaffirmation of your worth, and you panic when things aren't going your way. That's because, that's where you're looking for meaning. That's where you're looking for happiness. That's not the practice of Dharma. I don't know. That's the practice of self. And these words may sound strong, but they weren't meant in a harsh way. They were meant to point out to this person, there's a reason you continue to suffer. And it's because your understanding and your practice of Dharma is here. It's not here. Your practice of Dharma is wonderful when things are going right. but when we really need Dharma is when things are going, when the train is coming off the track. And that's the test. I'm just saying these things because he wanted help over here. Help me with my meditation practice. What am I doing wrong? I'm saying we're not even there yet. Your meditation practice is never going to work because you haven't adopted the basic view that Buddhism is wanting to teach you and using it to see clearly your life and the ups and downs and, why is this occurring? So it is very important that these fundamental teachings of, what's going on in this life, if there is suffering, unhappiness, what is the cause of it? Understanding cause and effect, why things unfold the way they do, and clearly understanding that when you do understand cause and effect, you clearly understand why they do or do not, right? When you use the tools that the tradition, that the lineage, that the Buddhas, the masters have given us, we will find that we will be successful. These reflections are really the foundation of practice. How were they discovered by the Buddha and the masters? Through the practice of mindfulness, which meant they were present to life. Through the practice of investigation, deep looking, they looked into life, they looked beneath the surface to see what was causing things to be the way they were. We don't, fortunately, have to do all that ourselves. There is a template that they've given us. What we have to do is take that template and experiment with that in our own life so we can really see, oh, It is a correct view of life, right? And the technology it uses to heal and transform and awaken is also very workable. I mean, that's our job, right? Which is a kind of an easy job, right? I mean, all I have to do is what? Follow the manual. Somebody else wrote the manual. I mean, that's really all it is. You know, the Buddha Dharma, the teachings, it's just a manual of how to wake up. How to lead a happy life, how to lead a life of ease and joy and compassion and loving kindness and patience and all those and generosity. You know, it's just a manual of how to do it. And all we have to do is what? You know, open the manual and realize it's a manual. Right? I mean, I don't think anybody here, you know, reads their car manual for recreational reading. Right? You know, we read the car manual because we're going to work on our car. Right? We're going to work on our dishwasher. We're going to put this piece of electronics together or something. You know, there's a practical application why we read a manual. But we're sort of strange people. We just love to buy manuals, you know, like called Buddhism or Hindu. You know, we just put them on our shelf. Man, you know, they're manuals. They're how to do it books. They're meant to be put into practice. You know, recently in our intensive, when we did our first section on mindfulness, you know, I recommended people read Thich Nhat Hanh's Miracle of Mindfulness, you know, his first book that was published in the West. It wasn't even a book. It was really it was actually a manual that he wrote for his students in the School of Buddhist Social Service in Vietnam to help them practice under difficult conditions. It was called a manual. It was called a manual for social activists or something. That was the Miracle of Mindfulness. I mean, that's every time I pick it up, I go, yeah, this is how, you know, how profound and simple. Right? You don't need any other book. I mean, well, you could use a few other books, but you don't need too many. I mean, it's you know, if we just followed that one, our life would be transformed, right? And yet, there are probably people here who have 40 of Thay's books now. All the manuals are on the shelf, and yet we haven't even practiced the first one yet. So again, we're looking over here, but the problem may be over here. Right. Yeah, really reflecting on life, Four Noble Truths, cause and effect, things like that, very important. Preciousness of life, the opportunities we've been given. We need to reflect in this way because it puts then our practice and what we're doing in perspective. It energizes this moment. We understand why we're here. Side teachings related to cause and effect, suffering of human existence, impermanence. Fundamental Buddhism teaches non-self. Right? Everybody here has heard that. the self is the fundamental cause of our delusion. It is the fundamental misperception. It is because of that that we get into all the trouble we do. And yet, most of us are still living primarily from ourself, for ourself, through ourself. We cannot walk around, even at a beautiful place like a retreat, without having lots of self thoughts. How do I make myself more comfortable? And what's wrong with all these other selves? You know, I mean, it's, you know, even on the sacred ground of the Buddha Dharma and the meditation hall, this self-mind will just keep running on, won't it? And yet, we are told right from the beginning, this is the problem. Ultimately, we want direct meditative experience seeing into the empty nature of the self. But for starters, we can know the I thought. We can know the me thought. And when it arises, we can see what it is and let it go. Right? But to do that, we have to be clear in our mind that the I thought, the me thought, you know, is what it is, and it is the source of my separation. It is the source of my disconnection from life, from others. It is the source of all the afflictive emotions that I want to be free of. You cannot have afflictive emotions without a self, a me that all this is happening to. Or not happening to. Why do we worry? We worry about the self. What's going to happen to it in the future? And we imagine all kinds of scenarios. Right? Why do we get sad? Because the self feels it's lost something. The self feels it needs something. Why do we get angry? Because things aren't going the way the self wants it to go. All these things that the self is imposing is contaminating the fresh moment with. If we can't name it, if we can't see it, if we can't let it go, then we are lost in the drama of self. Again, this is just fundamental Buddhism. It opens us up to what? A word that we hear again, over and over again. Selfless. Now, ultimately, we want to be selfless by really seeing into that self is really a non-self. Is anybody interested in looking into this whole thing about self being non-self? Yeah, why don't we do it right now? But can we get a little air conditioning? It's a little warm in here, or is it me? It's me? Oh, okay. No, nobody else is warm? No. It is. Some people are warm. Maybe because I'm drinking a little tea. Could be. Is it cool enough to open windows? Yeah, that's great. We could do both. Wow. Huh? Oh, that's fine. Yeah, it's good when we're having a Dharma talk to keep the air moving and be a little cool, right? We get sleepy. I mean, all you have the luxury of falling asleep. I have to stay awake, so I'm not asleep. Thank you, Charlie. let us begin by introducing the quality of wakefulness into our minds. Wakefulness, mindfulness, awareness, presence, variations on a theme, but what it means right now is I am awake to what is going on around me. I am awake to my body. I am awake to my breath. I am awake to the sound of this voice. I am awake to the cool breeze of the AC or the window open air on my body. I'm present. There may be thoughts arising, but I don't follow them. I'm just awake to them and let them pass through. We want to cultivate this quality of wakefulness. It's nothing extraordinary. You might say you're just 100% present. You have turned on the light of mindfulness within you and without you. So take a moment to turn on that light. Turning on the light is mindfulness. Keeping it lit moment to moment is concentration. It means the mind is unified on maintaining this present awareness. Diligent effort means there is energy behind your practice of concentration and mindfulness. So all three are present. And you don't have to grit your teeth or make yourself tense. You can be very relaxed and aware. So the mind is relaxed, but wakeful. The mind is not grasping or holding on to anything. Its wakefulness is like the sky. Things can blow through it. It is not disturbed. So if you open your eyes and you look very steadfastly at this, can everybody see this? So just look at this. And as you are looking totally absorbed in this, say to yourself, I am looking at the flowers. And that's what it feels like for most of us, right? If I asked you what you were doing, you'd say, I'm looking at the flowers. Or if I said, who's looking at the flowers? You would say, who? Me. I. Right? Ginny would say, hi, Ginny, I'm looking at the flowers, right? Rosario would say, no, I'm looking at the flowers. Tony would say, yeah, I'm looking at the flowers. Me, Tony, I'm looking at the flowers, right? So please look at the flowers and notice that when you ask yourself who's looking at the flowers, the answer would come, me, I am looking at the flowers. And so allow yourself to be aware that the sense of that there's something looking at the flower is rooted in this word I or me. I am looking at the flowers. Who's looking at the flowers? Somebody asks you the question, why me, of course. Isn't it obvious, right? Of course it's obvious, common sense. So please let that sense of I, of me, looking at the flowers, be very strong. Of course I'm looking at the flowers. Who else could be looking at them? It's me. Okay. Now, having established that there is a me, there is an I, who is looking at the flowers, obviously looking through the eyes at the flowers, that I or me, if it exists, can be seen, can be known. So right now, as you are saying, it is I, me, who is looking at the flowers, look right into your mind, or right where that voice that said me or I is coming from, and look to see what is it? What is it that said I or me? And I don't mean think about it, I mean actually look into your mind. If something exists, it has to be perceived. That's just common sense. Right? If I hear voices that are telling me to do this and that, and if somebody says to me, Fred, there's nobody telling you to say, you know, there's nobody giving you these directions. Your TV is not talking to you. Right? People would send me for a mental health assessment. Right? If I said I hear voices telling me this and that, but they cannot be found. So we have to, there has to be a real, so when you look at these flowers with the sense I am looking at the flowers, and you look for that I, that me, that self, that is saying it is looking at the flowers, when you look directly for it, what do you see? What do you see back there in your mind? What do you see, Jenny, when you look back there?
Really nothing, but it's a concept I have.
Well, hold on, do you see something called the concept when you look there?
Not really, no.
Well, okay, I know you're a lawyer, Jenny. You're on the stand, that's a yes or no question.
No.
Is there somebody back there or not? Well, that's interesting, isn't it? I mean, isn't that interesting?
It is.
It is. Other people, when you look, again, we acknowledge that it feels like, it appears like, you know, I am looking at this flower. But when we stop to practice deep looking into, looking under the surface, who else has looked into their mind where that I or me seem to be coming from? What do you see?
A thought.
You see a thought. And when you look right at that thought, then what do you see?
It's left.
It's left. So if something is real, not only does it have some kind of shape or object, but it must have some kind of permanence, right? If it's, right? So if it doesn't, if it cannot be found in as a thing, and it has no permanence, it's, you look at it and it's disappeared, we would call that what? A phantom, right? Anybody else? I mean, this is not rocket science. You don't have to have a PhD in Buddhism or psychology to get this. This is very simple. It is so simple that we can't believe it.
I see a flower.
You see a flower. But when I say to you, Rosaria, that eye who said she sees a flower, when you look for the source of that eye, what do you see in your mind?
An image.
An image, what?
An image of the flower.
No, I'm asking you to go the other way. See, there are two things we want to look at, right? Things, the phenomenal world, but also that which is perceiving the phenomenal world, the internal. So in Buddhism, it's called the twofold emptiness. You know, there is the world of things that we perceive, like perceiving the flower. But then there's this other thing, which is, you know, there is a sense that there's an I here, there's a me, the desire, that is perceiving the flower. So in the same way that Thay often talks about that this flower, which appears so solid and self, is really not. It's made up of lots of parts. There's really nothing solid there called the flower. It's turning the same investigation the other way, because this is the other place where we see solidity, right? We think there's a me, there's an I, there is a Rosaria. That's a thing, and she's stable over time, right? So we want to look into that the same way we look into this flower to see, is that true? Because in a certain sense, that is even more significant than this, because it is our sense of self that is always, you know, getting us into trouble, right? So we want to see, is there really something there? Or is it like the flower? It appears, but there's nothing solid there. It's just made up of parts, right? So we want to look into, there is something that is perceiving these flowers, right? You're saying it is me, it is Rosaria, it is I. And what I'm saying is, well, go into that part of your mind where that voice is coming from, you know, and what do you see there? It's really quite fascinating. It's as fascinating as looking at the flower and thinking there's a real flower there, and then just taking it apart. And all of a sudden you have petals and stems and this and that, I mean pieces, and there's no flower. What happened to the flower that we thought was there? It never really existed. It had a temporary existence when the parts come together, right? It just temporarily, right? But there's nothing there called a flower that is a permanent, self-existent entity unto itself. Who else has looked into the perceiver of the flower? What do you see? Anybody find the perceiver? What do you find? I mean, everybody's looking. What do you see when you look for the perceiver? There feels like, there seems to be, there must be. We talk as if there is, right? Yeah, I'm looking at the flower. Right? But when we look into it, is there a thing there? Is there a perceiver? That which is perceiving. What do you see, Charna?
Well, the physical body, its ability to perceive, is perceiving that it's thinking. I mean, it's just thinking.
Okay. So that is a... That's a little story you told me about that, but I want to know, what is your direct experience? See, again, if I said to you, Charna, right, tell me about, you know, what does this cup of tea taste like? Now, Charna can say, well, it is my tongue perceiving a sensation on it that is transmitted to the central nervous system, right? And that's very interesting, but that's not what I'm asking you. I'm asking you, Charna, what does tea taste like? Charna would have to taste it. Yeah, and if I said to you, right, so it's like that, Charna. It's hard for us because we are so used to thinking about things rather than directly experience things.
But the body is trained apart, but the parts are at this time, it can perceive that flower. But it's temporary.
Yeah, but that's not the question I'm asking you. You see, because what you just described me, even if that was correct, which it may be, you're describing a physical process of a body. Mm-hmm. But you're telling me, You're not, you don't say, when I hold up the flower, do you say, I, that's E-Y-E, I flower? No, you say, I see the flower. You see, you have something extra, don't you? Right? So you got something extra, very important. You say what? I see the flower. There is this thing called me who sees the flower. It's not just, it's just not seeing flower. It's not just seeing, right? So that's very interesting. So the question I'm asking you is, this I that sees the flower, what is that? You say it's not really there, but you look for it?
Well, I can't find any separate stuff, as she said.
You can't find anything. So in Ginny's logical world, if you're looking for something and it's not there, therefore you have to conclude what? It's not there. There you go. Again, as I say, this is, you don't need an advanced degree in logic to get this one. Very simple. Let's keep it simple, right? It's not there. If it is not there in any cognizant way, then we would have to say it does not exist in any solid, permanent way, right? In the same way, we might say, oh, I see the flower, and it certainly appears to be a flower here. But again, if I, and I don't want to hurt the flower, if I took it apart and just, you know, crumpled it up and ripped the flowers, there'd be no more flower, just like that. It would take 30 seconds to show us that there's no such thing as a flower there. They're just a bunch of parts that have come together that has a certain appearance that we ascribe permanence to. Right? But it's really just parts. Parts that have come together according to causing conditions. When causing conditions change, it will change. There's nothing solid there. So we might say, the flower is not a flower. In the Diamond Sutra, it says things like, the flower is not a flower, therefore we call it a flower. Only Buddhists talk like that. Right? When you know that a flower is really not a flower, then you can really appreciate it for what it is. It's just a flower, but you don't see it. But when you understand its impermanent, non-self nature, you won't what? You won't be sobbing away when it begins to get a little brown, will you? You won't go into a dark, despairing tailspin when you come in one day and all the petals have fallen to the ground, will you? Because you understand that a flower is not really a permanent, self-existent thing. It's just temporary. So you're able to enjoy the flower, right? Do we enjoy the flower? A beautiful flower. But we don't cling to it. We're not attached to it because we know its nature. Right? I mean, this is very simple, but this is the way it is. I mean, if we can do it with a flower, we can do it with our children, we can do it with our bodies, we can do it with our workmates, I mean, we can do it with anything. It's the same. Do you see the freedom in that? Yes, Spence.
It's for the eye.
This is the, not the I, E-Y-E?
No, the I.
The I, yeah.
I've heard it described as the undefined consciousness, or kind of universal consciousness, that you can't really define it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just maybe it's related to the non-self concept.
So when you say things like that, what was that undefined consciousness? What does that give you?
Well, there's consciousness, you know, it's maybe in the flower. You know, there's consciousness in a tree or a plant knows to move towards the sun, there's consciousness there. Some type of consciousness. And maybe
you're scaring me, Spence.
That's okay. But
I mean, do you talk to flowers?
You could.
Okay. All right, just checking.
There is consciousness in the universe that you can't necessarily define.
What if I really said to you, Spence, you know what? You are the universe. If the universe is everything, then you are the universe. And as soon as you start talking about something called the universe, you are separating yourself from who you are. Do squirrels and rabbits talk about the natural world? Do they? No. They are, that's what we call the natural world. Yeah, they don't go around saying, I am. As soon as they said, I'm part of the natural world, they're no longer in the natural world, are they? They've separated themselves from it. You can call yourself, you can call yourself universal mind, Buddha mind, pure and adulterated consciousness, the Godhead, right? We can call ourselves, right? Like we can call this flower anything, couldn't we? Right? You could give it, many, many different names. But at the end of the day, it's just this, isn't it? And what do all those names, do all those names make this any better or worse? No. So this is why in this tradition, direct experience, seeing things as they are.
Sometimes this concept like non-self or undefined consciousness does help you to maybe transcend that.
Is that what you found in your own life?
Yeah, I think these Buddhist concepts help you to transcend and go with the self.
To some degree, but the problem is that which is in charge of letting go of the self is usually the self. So, we're just kind of moving, as they say, we're moving the deck chairs around on the Titanic. For example, take mindfulness practice, which is at the core of our practice. There are actually two different kinds of mindfulness. Beginning mindfulness is we might say, is directive mindfulness, right? It's where self is still very present. I am looking at a flower. Now, that is a statement of mindfulness, right? There's an awareness that there's looking, the flower's there, I'm here. It's certainly getting us in the ballpark, right? It's kind of becoming aware. Yeah, I am washing the dishes. I am talking to you. When there was no awareness, right, and it was all just fabrication, right, kind of getting clean that's what's going on is very helpful, isn't it? Right. But there's still duality. There's an I looking at you. Right. So the next step of real deeper mindfulness is, it's just this. Just looking. No subject, no object. Right. In the beginning, I am washing the dishes, and it has to be very directive, and that's helpful. I am touching the earth. Helpful. Because before we were, anywhere but. We didn't know what we were doing. But again, we want to, the deepening of praxis is when things like mindfulness and concentration are just natural aspects of our mind. Right? We are just naturally mindful. We are experiencing without having to direct ourselves. And without a sense of I, because there is no I, as Ginny just showed us, right? As Charna just reaffirmed, unless it's because they're sitting next to each other. Maybe somebody back there. I feel like I just want to make sure, there's no collusion going on here. That is a little suspicious. Did anybody back there look for their look for their eye, and what did you find?
Nothing.
All right, there's Tammy. Tammy, are you related to these two people? No, not at all. You don't live near them or anything? Okay. You didn't talk beforehand about no collusion? I just want. Okay. So are we clear? Tammy, when you look for the eye that perceives these flowers, what did you see?
Nothing.
Okay. There's nothing there. And that has been replicated for 2,600 years. I mean, this is not anything made up. This is just basic Buddhist psychology. There is no self. You see how simple it is? It sounds so radical because we grew up in a psychology, in a world where self our self is reinforced from where we're little. These are your toys. Good boy, good girl, that a boy, that a girl, good job, right? We're reinforced right from the very early stages about ourself, and this is mine, and this is yours, and this is your name, and right? Again, I mean, it's kind of a hazard of growing up, but that's what happens. And then, we live in a society where self is constantly reaffirmed, right? And we're to be independent, to be self-reliant, to only rely on yourself, right? I mean, this is very much our culture, so it just gets reinforced. So it's hard for us often to understand that other cultures do not have the same psychology that we have. Cooperation and interdependence and things like that, interbeing, are much more the operating principles of a society or a culture. But it all begins with the I. Charner, do you ever get angry at anybody? And why do you get angry at somebody?
I want something.
Right. Right. Everybody here, Chana, she said it's because the I wants something it didn't get or got something it didn't want. Right. So again, with anger, there's always the presence of self, the presence of I. If there's no I, if there's no self present, the same interaction is going on, but it's not about me anymore, is it? The person just did what they did, or the person just didn't do what they didn't do. Or life is just unfolding this way, and life is just not unfolding that way. It's, right? It's much more understandable. But with the self, there's no understanding, is there? Because it makes everything about itself. And yet, as we just saw, this self, that's such a, makes a big deal about everything. It's just, we call it a delusion, right? A delusion is a strongly held belief that is irrational. It is delusional. So, so that was just an example of somebody raising their hand in the back there. I can't quite see.
But the same token, if you get angry because somebody did something that I didn't like, by the same token, if you get happy and glad, then it's because somebody did something that you like and you enjoy it, you back it up. So then there's no happiness.
Oh, good point. Oh. Trying to trick me, my own mother is trying to show me up to be the fool. Okay. So we had somebody ask, they asked, I understand that about sadness or anger and all this, but what about when the eye gets what it wants, or things are going the way the eye wants and it gets happy? If you eliminate that, then you have a world that's just kind of flat, right? No, you don't, actually. But one thing you said was very true, and that is why, quote-unquote, worldly happiness is not highly rated in Buddhist psychology. Why is it not highly rated? Because it doesn't mean it's not acknowledged. Obviously, on an everyday level, would we rather things go our way than didn't go away? Well, of course, right? Would we rather have happy circumstances than unhappy circumstances? On a common sense level, of course. But the problem is, just as we said, as Charna said, it doesn't always work that way. Sometimes things, people do what we want, and sometimes they don't do what we want. Sometimes things, situations go our way, sometimes they don't go our way. The problem in the world of duality, if you want one, you are naturally stuck with the opposite when it doesn't occur. That's the problem with that kind of worldly happiness, you see, because, like you said, when things are going your way, you're up. When things aren't going your way, you're down. And therefore, you have life as just up and down, up and down, up and down. Now, please understand, the Buddha saw this 2,600 years ago. This is not a new discovery. He called that up and down. You know what he called that? Yeah, samsara, or the world of suffering. He said that up and down is suffering. You're gaining, you're losing, you're happy, you're unhappy. You know, overall, he said, that's not real happiness. Okay. That is why, again, as you know, in the seven factors of awakening, there is joy. There is equanimity. There is ease. There are these positive mindsets, but they're not coming from how the world is going. You see, it's coming from a different kind of, it's coming from the cultivation of mindfulness, concentration, insight, loving kindness. You see, it's the basis is different. And the basis of that can be consistent, because it is not predicated on external up and downs. That's the danger of that, can you see? That's what it's about. So, obviously, you walk out on a beautiful day like this, you feel happy, right? It's just, there's no effort. But again, hopefully, when you came down the stairs or walked out of the Franciscan Center and saw, you already were happy. Do you see what I'm saying? I mean, you already had a sense of well-being within you. And then you just kind of ramps it up a little bit. In the same way, if you got bad news that somebody you love died, it would bring it down a little bit, right? I mean, one is a human being and has a normal, has emotions, but they're not so extreme and they're not so predicated on the world, because the world is what? Remember we talked about that earlier, because we understand the world is impermanent. Everything is changing all the time. I mean, there's no stability, right? Right? Stock market goes up, everybody feels what?
Great.
Great. Everybody feels great, you know. Stock market goes down, everybody feels what? Terrible. Fear. You know, it's like, as if somehow, I don't need to go into it, it's right, I've said before, you go to a party and everybody says, oh, Rosario, we're so happy to see you. Rosario feels wonderful, right? Life of the party, center of it. Rosario goes to a party, doesn't know anybody, nobody talks to her, she feels terrible, right? I mean, it's that kind of, rather than just having a sense of well-being and an understanding, that when you go to a party where everybody knows you, people will know you. When you go to a party where nobody knows you, nobody will know you, and that's, you're okay with that because you have understanding. But if there's no understanding, if it's just self, self always wants what?
Praise.
Well, yeah, wants praise. You always want to be the right center of the party, right? And when we're not the center of the party, ignored, self feels bad. I mean, that's just the way it is, isn't it? That's the world of self, grasping at the world of phenomena that is inherently impermanent, unstable, and wanting stability. Is that clear? But the stability it wants, interestingly enough, is always its way. Right? You see, it wants the stability of people always liking it. I mean, it doesn't want the stability of people always disliking them. Right? So we want the permanence our way. But again, it can't be that way. Right. You know, we would like all our loved ones to be happy and to live forever and never be sick or have a problem. Isn't that true? Of course. And yet the truth is what? That only happens in Disney World. Right? Mickey will always look the same. Right? Pocahontas, you know what I mean? They'll all, you know, you could come back, you know, 10 lifetimes from now. You know, and Mickey won't have aged a moment. And Donald will still be there, you know, the whole thing. Right? But that's not real, is it? Maybe that's why people like it so much. There is one stable thing in the world, right? The Magic Kingdom. I mean, even Disney acknowledges it's not real. The Magic Kingdom. So, yes. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. Turn my head more. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah.
You must be very, very slow today. And, you know, going through the flower thing with you.
Mm-hmm.
Quite a few times.
Let's do it again. I actually never get bored with it. I always.
When I got stuck on the squirrel.
This. Uh-huh. Okay. What happened with the squirrel?
Well, at some point there, you know, we're talking at our ego eye looking at the flower, and then whether the flower is looking back at us, you know, kind of worries.
Mm-hmm.
And then somehow you went off into the squirrel. the squirrel and the birds. And so if the squirrel is looking at a nut, an acorn, what does the squirrel see?
First of all, does the squirrel know it's an acorn?
I don't know.
No. But we know the squirrel has no language. The squirrel sees that, and it knows, and when it sees that, it knows it's food. But it doesn't know that by thinking, oh, there's food. It knows it in a very direct way, right?
But didn't we used to be like that?
Yes, we did. You're right on target. Exactly right.
So?
Because we split. See, that's why we have to practice. That's why I'm, you know, now at the end of the Dharma talk, coming back. So, you know, where does this all lead us to practice? Yeah, we have to come home. So when we recite Thay's Gata, listen, this wonderful bell brings me back to my true home or true self, it means I come home by what? By just being present. There's no me, there's no bell, there's just bong, right? And I'm having, now there's no separation. I've entered the world of non-separation. The squirrel is in the world of non-separation. We all, as young children, infants, were in the world of non-separation. But over time, you know, child developmental psychology will tell us how self develops around 1.5, 2 years old, and it gets defined and reinforced, and you know, and it just, you know, gets worse and worse as more and more we reify around this notion of ourself as a separate self. We have lots of identities, we have lots of issues, we have lots of, you know, and it just, you know, and we're kind of stuck with this thing, which just at the end of the day just isolates us. Right? We're isolated with our own self-identity. Is that clear? And so mindfulness practice gets us out of that. Because one, it shows us, right, what's really going on. Right? mindfulness says, this is right in front of me. This. I can see this. I am present to this. But those are words. But I mean, and when mindfulness reveals that to me, anything that comes after, such as it's a pretty flower, it's an ugly flower, I want this flower, where is that coming from? Is that coming from the flower? No. Mindfulness reveals it's just being projected by my own thoughts. Oh. Right? So mindfulness allows us to see clearly. Concentration allows us to see more clearly, so I can really spend a few moments really looking into this matter, okay? I'm able to concentrate on it. I'm not just flickering around, right? If I look here, if I'm kind of ADD, I'm all over the place, I will never notice it. So I have to, you know, Thay calls it stopping, you know. He calls concentration stopping. You know, we have to, mindfulness reveals, stopping allows us to focus on it, and then deep looking allows us to look into. What is this really? Okay. So that's why these practices all come together. And they're just about what you said. It's, as I said, you know, this original nature is right here. It's just covered up. But as you can see, it can be revealed if we know how to look. So when we give instructions like we've given, begin by practicing mindfulness, presence, whatever you want to call it, wakefulness, of being in your body. Squirrels in their bodies and in their senses. Young children in their bodies and senses. That's where their awareness is. They're not in the world of conceptualization, of thinking and projection, right? That's the split. So mindfulness allows us to return so we can have direct experience. We can see, we can taste, we can smell, we can feel, right? In very direct experiential ways. I mean, again, I think one of the geniuses of Thich Nhat Hanh in this current age is he took mindfulness, which was always sort of in the meditative tradition as the foundation for the meditative life, because he could see the alienation of human beings these days. I understand it, just everyday mindfulness is needed, so people can just come back into life and be able to just experience life, you know, what's happening in front of them, right? Not only use it as a tool for awakening, it's right. So we sort of need both. Mindful living, living mindfully, allows us to connect, to be present to feel connected to what we're seeing, what we're feeling, what we're smelling, what we're tasting, and even what we're feeling, because we are directly experiencing it. When you live with mindfulness, which means you are connected, I mean, Thich Nhat Hanh, he says, you know, he's a poet, so he says nice things. He says, so when you're looking, he says, your eye is touching the object you see. It's very kind of beautiful. Your ears are touching the sound. There's intimacy, this connection. It's not I am listening to the sound. My eye is touching the tree. Is that clear? So we want to practice mindfulness, and the simplest way to do it is come out of your head and come down into your body. And again, your body means your senses. And as you go about your activities, move with your body. And as you look at things, like during the breaks or solitary practice, feel that you are connecting with whatever you're seeing. You're not just passing your gaze. You're connecting with the sounds, connecting with the feelings in your body, by resting in them. Are we clear? So this is where we'll begin with this fundamental practice of mindfulness. Mindfulness of the body in the body. Again, and you can practice this in your meditation. You can practice this when you're walking. You can practice this when you're laying down in your bed. You can practice this when you're eating. Again, your mindfulness will reveal when you are not doing that. When you are lost in some thought or some story, when your mindfulness will reveal that to you. As soon as that has been revealed to you, I was talking to somebody this morning in the interviews, talking about how they kind of notice they're distracted and then they have to work their way back to mindfulness. And I said, no, absolutely not. These Americans, they love to work. No, when you are mindful that you are, distracted or lost in some thought, at that moment, you are mindful. Don't you understand? You are mindful. Mindfulness, the light has gone on. You see where you are. You don't have anything, you don't have to do anything else. You don't have to get back to mindfulness. You are mindful, right? You just let go of the as we say, you know, mindful. Again, these are just words. Smriti means more than just being present. It means attention. It means remembering. It means recollection. It has lots of meaning. So mindfulness not only reveals where we are right now, but has the capacity of recollecting and remembering where we want to be. So as soon as we notice that I have gotten, involved in a thought form, as soon as I am mindful of that, the light has gone on, and I just, notice that I am breathing, or I notice that my body is right here. That's all. Just a little immediate shift of attention. Is that clear? Don't make it into a 7-step process. It's much simpler than that. So any questions? Yes, Spencer.
So the idea is to become more, I guess you said squirrel-like, is it?
I would say, Spence, you can pick your model. If squirrels move you, squirrels are fine. Birds, rabbits, Buddhas, you can. Alligators, whatever moves you. Yes. When you're out there walking, and all of a sudden you see this little thing, this little gray thing in the tree, kind of looking at you, making its little noise. He's just looking. You just look back. You can make a sound back at him. Two squirrels meeting in the woods.
Quite a conversation.
It actually may turn out to be one of the more enlightening conversations you've had. Good. So are there any final questions? So good. Again, wonderful opportunity to practice mindfulness, concentration, joyful effort. This is, this is not hard work. This is joyful work. We are returning home. We have a path. We have a way to do it. So we should feel good about that.